All right. Well, welcome, and I'm thrilled to be here to be able to talk a little bit about moving towards a definition of freedom. I've got a couple little graphs that I'll show, but other than that, I'm just going to speak from notes. So, I thought a fun anecdote that Eric had told me as we've been working on this project which is the free content and expression definition, was that. Until recently, the front page of Wikipedia said that Wikipedia is a free content encyclopedia. It's now changed to say a free encyclopedia, but the link in both cases points to the article on free content. Similarly, if you go to the Wikimedia Foundation homepage, it describes the goal is to produce free multilingual content. Again, with a link to the same article, this free content. And what's funny is that the board member Florence Nibard-Devoir pointed out that the article in Wikipedia on free content was ambiguous and not up to the standards of the Wikipedia project, and that and in particular that it didn't cite any references, that it was talking about this idea of free content, but it wasn't clear what free content was. That's an interesting idea. We've got a project that self-identifies as producing something called free content, but which has never defined free content even to a point that's satisfactory for the people doing it. So we know what it is that we're doing. We're creating free content. And in other situations where people say we're creating free culture or so on and so forth, but we don't know what that is. So part of what I'm going to do today is argue for a definition of freedom first, a definition of free content, a definition of free expression, and I'm going to argue why I think that's important. I'm going to use some history to do that. I'm then going to argue for a particular definition, which is a definition that Eric and myself and a number of other people in the Wikipedia and Wikimedia community, and in the broader sort of free content, free expression, and free culture communities have been working on. And we're calling that the free content and expression definition right now, although we're still talking about names, and it's not too late to either change the content of the definition or the name, so we can have that conversation. And then I guess finally we're going to argue in favor of a social movement, for a new or a more cohesive social movement with the goals of implementing this definition or our kind of, the definition that we can come to consensus around. So in arguing for a definition, we look back to the explicit source of inspiration, not only for people like, for people like Wikipedia and for a lot of people that identify as creating free content and free expression. And that's the free and the open source software movements. I think that it's when looking at the free software movement, it's useful to look at a set of what I call defining moments. These are moments when not only are they defining in terms of setting the being important points in the history or turning points in the history of free and open source software. They're also points where people offer definitions. The first and most important of these was the free software definition written by Richard Stallman. People are probably familiar with it. They'd be familiar with it. Even if they haven't read it, they're probably familiar with the contents. This is the famous four freedoms. People that want free software is software that lets users use the software. It's for any purpose. It's software that lets people modify it, distribute it, and then collaborate on it. To paraphrase, this definition was then modified in the open source. Was sort of adapted into the Debian Free Software Guidelines, which were adapted into the open source definition. The important point is that while the text differs and the nature of the document differs pretty radically in all of those examples, in all of those examples, the freedom that is defined as essential is identical. Each of those are trying to protect the freedom to use, the freedom to modify, the freedom to collaborate, the freedom to distribute copies. In each of these, what this has done is it's provided a constitution for the free software movement. I've heard people refer to the GPL, which is a particular license. It's the most important license, and it's the most frequently used license, as the constitution of the free software movement. But I think that that's incorrect, because it's not the license to which all software must be held, because before there was the GPL, there was free software. There was software that was, you know, in fact, the history of free software is actually is trying to get back to a time. You know, Richard wanted to get back to a time when people shared software. So in this sense, it's not any particular license, and in fact, there are many free software licenses. The Free Software Foundation, the Debian Project, the Open Source Initiative, each list many licenses, at this point hundreds of licenses, that each qualify as free software or as open source licenses. But because each of these are held to a standard of freedom, a demarcated standard of freedom, the free software definition and the definitions that came after it have drawn a line in the sand. They said, if you're on this side of the line, what you're doing is free, what you're doing is open. If you're on that side of the line, what you're doing is not. In some situations, there may be a value judgment attached to that. If you're not doing free software, you're taking away people's freedom. In other situations, there's simply a pragmatic argument that if you release your stuff as open source software, it will be better. But in all situations, there's a fine line distinguishing these two things. As we know, this is kind of, this has led to a successful social movement, and many people have wanted to join and do it on different terms. There's been many new free software licenses, and there's been a lot of debate about whether a license is free or not, open or not. And the existence of this debate is important because it shows that, because it demonstrates a couple things. One is that is that the term, even though in both situations the terms are not trademarked, I think that's right. There was an attempt to use open source as a trademark, but it didn't end up working out. Even though someone could call their things free, open source, Microsoft went up with a new word. They created a new word to describe what they were doing. They called it shared source, because it wasn't open source, and because they knew it wasn't open source, and more importantly, because everyone else knew it wasn't open source, because they didn't allow those four freedoms, and they didn't allow it to the extent that the existing community would approve of. As a result, what is offered is a clear and a shared vision around which this movement was built. There are different groups within the movement that have different motivations, but there's still a clear vision. So the open source and free software can work together, even though they disagree about why they're doing what they're doing, because they agree that what they are doing falls within a shared definition of freedom. The end result is also that there are many people who release their software as free software or as open source because they're challenged to do so. Developers want their software to be in Debian. Developers want their software to be in Ubuntu. Developers want their software to be called open source. They want their software on SourceForge. Each of these, but in order to do any of these things, they must release their software as open source software or as free software. They must satisfy these four freedoms. In that way the free software community has grown. It's also grown because it's existed in this, it's had a set of these legal instruments, licenses, a set of social instruments and technological instruments, internet version control systems, all of these things. So the result historically, do people remember shareware? It's a funny question because even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, and even 10 years ago, there was lots of software called shareware, and it was software that people, mostly volunteers, had written because they wanted it, and they put it on the network, or on a BBS, or even on the internet in the early days, and people could download it, and if you wanted to use it for more than 30 days, you would have to pay for it. And except in a couple small areas, I hear there's still shareware on Macs, but except in a couple small areas, shareware has been eliminated. It doesn't exist anymore in the way that it did before, because people are still writing software in their spare time. They're still distributing software in their spare time. They're doing it more than they ever were before, but they're releasing their stuff as open source software or as free software because there was a movement, because there was a goal, because there was a term, because they knew they could get their stuff distributed in Debian, so on and so forth. So the result ultimately is both more free software and more freedom overall. And ultimately the creation of a movement that has succeeded because it's provided an inspiration for lots of other people as well. So So I can move on from free software to the real kind of question at hand, which is the free content or free expression or free culture movement. There's lots of different names for it, but in most situations, there is an idea that people are trying to people who've been inspired by the success of this free and open software movement want to apply, you know, to apply the model to the production of other types of creative works. I mean, the very quick timeline, I suppose, is you know, we have in 2001, we have, you know, Wikipedia hits the net and people start creating articles, and we all know what happens after that. About a year later, the Creative Commons Project launches and releases at first one or two licenses and then a much larger stable of licenses, which have grown. These licenses do a variety of things, which people are probably familiar with. They allow you to pick and choose options. I want non-commercial use. I want you to be able to make derivative works. I don't want you to be able to make derivative works. And then, you know, there's been an increase in the use of free content or the use of these licenses in a variety of places. In I guess 2 years ago, Flickr started allowing people to, you know, use Creative Commons licenses to distribute their content or to explain to people that they wanted their pictures to be free. And that was one of the first really mainstream sites that started using these licenses. But in all of these cases, the people behind these decisions in these movements were quick to both to adopt both the instruments and the tactics of the free and open source software movement. Creative Commons explicitly cites the GNU GPL as the source of inspiration. It doesn't cite the free software definition as the source of inspiration, but the license itself. It's also created a set of standardized licenses, something that existed to varying degrees in free and open source software. The idea of copyleft, the idea of letting people use your work, but only if they agree to share as well, and some of the models and the technological systems that allow for you know, open collaboration. But as a whole, the community that, you know, so this is the pieces that it took. But what it didn't take was, I mean, first, most obviously, the free software community's vision or its definition of freedom. If you look at the licenses that Creative Commons offers, which is, you know, the most visible sort of, you know, centerpiece in the free culture movement, you'll see that those licenses allow for non-commercial, for blocking all commercial use, for blocking all derivative versions. In fact, for the first couple years, the only thing they all allowed was verbatim non-commercial use. Now, with time, actually, that's gone away as well, because there are sampling licenses that only allow you to use bits and pieces of a work, or a license that only allows you to use a work freely if you live in the developing world. But the point is that the free software community, that the free culture community, or the free content community, did not adopt the free. Not only did they not adopt the free software community's definition of freedom, they didn't adopt any definition of freedom. And I guess this is where we begin arguing for a definition, because to illustrate this point, the Creative Commons will say Creative Commons is about the freedom. It gives authors the freedom to choose how their works are licensed. And think about that, because a lot of people sort of clap, I think, without thinking about that. The freedom to choose how your works are licensed. You had that freedom before. There are some licenses that make it a little easier to sort of express that. And in some situations, that may be a very good thing, because it involves less permission asking. But in that sense, it's just an anti-lawyer sort of provision. It just cuts down on the permission asking in the contracts. Free software says these freedoms. Free software gives you the freedom to do X, Y, and Z. Explicit sort of freedoms. So we can use Creative Commons motto is some rights reserved, and it says a lot, because I mean, you can think about it. Some rights reserved. Which rights? Well, the answer is, well, it depends on the license you use. And it depends on which licenses we decide to add, you know, tomorrow or next year. Meanwhile, you know, free software says essential rights are unreservable. You can't take these away. You can't block my ability to reverse engineer something. This is essential freedom. In order to get to the free, you know, when we have freedom, this is what it will look like. As opposed to, well, let's get there somehow. The difference is an explicit challenge, you know, a social movement towards a vision of a free world, and explicitly challenging people to come and live in that world, and a sort of expression. Let's let people explain how they want their work to be used. So there've been some notable exceptions to this particular. Wikipedia is actually one of them. There's also some of the free standards work, and in some situations, some people that are working on open access to certain types of scientific knowledge have also come forward and said, if you want to call your stuff, you know, open science, it needs to be this. If you want to call your stuff an open standard, it needs to set, you know, live up to these criteria. Wikipedia has also made this, you know, with the exception for some certain fair use cases, all images that are uploaded to Wikimedia Commons must be free to copy and modify and distribute. So you can't, you know, and there's both there's both implicit use and an explicit reference to a set of definitions and a model of a model that sort of allows people to decide whether a license would be free or not. But what doesn't exist, even in Wikipedia, is a firm definition of what free content means for Wikipedia or free culture or outside of Wikipedia, a definition that exists that other people could use, or even a list of licenses that live up to this. Although the list of licenses is problematic because people write new licenses, there are new versions, and we need some way to evaluate whether a license is still free. And unless we have a definition, there's no way to do that. So, I mean, the results, not just for Wikipedia, but for the entire sort of free culture or movement, has been the introduction of licenses that are considered very controversial within the community. A lot of people became, when Creative Commons released their Developing Nations license, this is a license that anyone can use as long as they live in a developing country. A lot of people in the Creative Commons movement were very upset. They said, this license isn't free. This license isn't good enough. Because, you know, a developing nation might become a developed nation, and then do people lose the ability to use it? Or some people didn't like the sampling license because they felt that it was prohibitive to the point where he was just describing what was already in fair use, and in some situations may even be describing less of what's in fair use. Now, in fairness, there's a little disclaimer that says we're not taking away your fair use at the top. But if you're going to describe something that's less than fair use in some situations, why bother to do it in the first place? So a number of people were unhappy with this, but there was nothing that they could point to that said these licenses fail a litmus test because there was no test. There was no definition. Similarly, nobody, and perhaps more importantly, because there was no definition, no one was challenged to get inside the line. No one, in the way that people said, I want my stuff to be open source, or I want my stuff to be free software, I want it to be in Debian, no one was challenged to do it. It was challenged to release their stuff. The result of this has been that all Creative Commons licenses are presented equally, and you can probably guess what people have done. I have a little graph that shows some license usage. Oops. Let's see. Right. So there's one. This is the usage of Creative Commons licenses on Yahoo. And if you look, the big two spots right down there are the two most restrictive licenses that Creative Commons offers. That's the non-commercial, non-derivatives is the green one, and the blue one is the non-commercial share-alike license. And if you look at another graph of Flickr license use statistics, you can see something quite similar. The three big blocks are the biggest block is the most restrictive license, the non-commercial, non-derivative attribution license. The second big and the second biggest block is the yellow one, the non-commercial share-alike. So. We see here about 80% of all of the licenses used on Flickr, and about 80-85% of all Creative Commons works out there are under the two or three most restrictive licenses. A majority of licenses block commercial use, and a majority of licenses block derivative works. No one is being challenged to use. People go to a website and it says, "Which license do you want to use? Do you want to allow commercial use?" And natural conservatism takes over, and people say no, and people say no. The result is that the Creative Commons and the free culture movement have become a party that anyone can go to because there is nothing that anyone can object to. You can choose a license that is so restrictive that even, in fact, Jack Valenti and Hilary Rosen, former heads of the Motion Picture Association and Recording Industry Association of America, have both endorsed Creative Commons because they're not threatening and because people can choose just anything. So, in short, the legal and ethical kind of due to incompatibilities within this sort of graph, there's no strong push for maximizing freedom, and it's our hypothesis that a clear definition of freedom will lead to more free access and to more creative works, and can ultimately become the basis of a true sort of free content and free expression movement. In providing such a definition, our aims are pretty simple. We want to provide a clear goal for passionate individuals to work towards. We want to replicate what the Free Software Foundation and the Free Software Definition have done. We want to raise awareness of a set of issues and encourage people to around using more restrictive licenses, and we want to encourage people to use more permissive licenses. We also wanted to define a clear scope for the participation of individuals and organizations. If you want to play with us, these are the rules. If you want to call your stuff free, this is what you need to do. And now in doing so, I know that I've been a little critical of Creative Commons, but in fact, this doesn't preclude working with Creative Commons, and in fact, there's a strong symbiotic relationship that can exist. These licenses are the licenses that are the most permissive, which tend to be the less frequently used licenses, are the best licenses available. So we can continue to use the Creative Commons licenses, and we can continue to license our works using them. We'll just use a subset of them. So in that sense, Creative Commons sort of becomes the law firm for the free content and expression movement. So we can move on, and I can show you. The last bit is introducing the work that we've done so far on the definition. Our definition, tries to define free works and free licenses, and we do that by pulling pretty heavily from the example of the free software movement, but we've sort of listed we sort of required that works that are free content or free expression must permit use, and that includes commercial use, and distribution and study and modification, and distribution of derivatives, and they can allow for the protection of for certain tools that can be used to legal and technical tools that can provide freedom, like copyleft or anti-DRM clauses, for example. We also want to require that for a work to be free, the preferred form of modification should be available for it. The idea being that if you have, this is taken directly from the GPL, but the idea is that you may have a work and be able to and have every legal right to modify it, but if you don't have access to the you don't have the technical ability to modify it, it's not really free then, is it? So rights on paper that cannot be practiced are not good enough. And we've also required that there should be no other technical or legal restrictions that reduce freedom. The two most controversial bits up here are requiring that for something to be called free content, it must require commercial use and it must allow modification, which would not include the licenses that are most frequently used in Creative Commons, but the licenses that are more restrictive. We have a rationale that we've argued for this, but I can kind of quickly go over the key points, which are that the non-commercial licenses. Eric's written a great paper that called Creative Commons non-commercial licenses considered harmful, where he argues that for a number of reasons these are not a good thing to use. He says that they're incompatible with free software, and it's actually a really it's actually a good example because part of the reason free software has succeeded is because commercial use has, you know, companies have been able to get involved and to use and to use free software and to contribute to free software. And if you block commercial use, you're going to block most of the avenues that made the only other successful movement like this happen. You know, you're precluding that from happening. There's also many reasonable uses that become impossible, or at least impossible without asking permission. And there's some real questions of if it's even necessary when you have copyleft. So why block commercial use when you can require that anyone who uses the work has to share as well? So commercial people can still use it, they can still make money off of it, but they have to share their work as well, so you get to benefit just as much as they do. We also take a strong stance against blocking modifications because we think that people perhaps undervalue the use of derivative works and modifications, things like translations and performances, which for many types of works can make or break it. Also, they're not acceptable in non-commercial and non-commercial use clauses. Non-derivative work clauses are not acceptable in many important free content sort of or free culture sort of contexts like Wikipedia. If something doesn't allow modifications, it can't go in Wikipedia. It can't go into a free software project. It can't go into a variety of places. And perhaps more importantly, works under non-derivative work licenses can't be combined together. It's the combinatorial effect of software and of other types of creative goods that really makes them successful. And if you block ability to do modifications, you're going to be blocking that. So I guess we can return sort of briefly to Wikipedia. Because in the Wikipedia context, we found out that the definition for free content already points to the draft definition that we've been working on, which is and neither of us added it. But people have already noticed that this is a definition that they can work with. It's within the Wikipedia context, it describes explicitly what Wikipedia and Wikimedia has already been doing implicitly. It also sets a clear sets of terms for collaborations with other organizations and individuals. The idea is that we can now say, you know, this particular service is available for free if you're going to be working on it on a free content project. But if you're going to be implementing it into a non-free content project, you won't be able to use it. We have a set definition that we can point people to. They can look at their work and their creations and decide whether or not it's that way because it qualifies. And I think perhaps more importantly, it lets Wikipedia sort of expand what it's doing by describing what it's doing explicitly. It helps provide a set of ways that Wikimedia and Wikimedia can really work with a larger sort of social movement of people, you know, social movement of people who are working on other sorts of free culture issues. These are the ground rules. This is the movement. Wikipedia can be the most important kind of piece in this, but it's a set of ground rules which we can literally share because we know that if a license passes this set of criteria, it's something that can go into, you know, Wikimedia Commons. It's something that can become part of the encyclopedia, and it's also and it also provides for a larger, more nebulous sort of movement of people who are doing something that they agree is good. Moving forward, our goal is to keep working on this license. You can keep working on it too, because we've got, of course, we have our definition in a wiki, and we are encouraging people. We've already encouraged people in Wikimedia, and are encouraging more people to come and collaborate on this, and to sort of argue for or against decisions that we've made, and to help sort of move forward. So our first step is sort of creating this definition, and we believe that because this is something that's going that we want to apply to a very broad community, we want as much sort of collaboration within that community as possible. Similarly, I guess the next step is to take this from a definition to a social movement, which is of course the hard part. Writing up a document is pretty easy. That takes maybe a few weeks, but building a successful social movement takes a long time. It's pretty easy when you don't set the ground rules, because then anyone who wants to come in come and play can do it. But in this case, we're going to have to argue hard for things, and more importantly, we're going to have to prove by doing. Now the good news is that Wikimedia and Wikipedia in particular has done a lot of proving by doing already, and we can cite that, and we can continue to use that. But moving forward, we're going to have to continue to argue for this and sort of push for, you know, push for this in different places, for educational sort of resources, and you know, we have a list of other sorts of areas where we want to avoid effort and kind of starting new initiatives and awareness campaigns. And that moving forward. So with that out of the way, I'm happy to take questions, and I'll invite Eric up as well, who's been working on this project, if he can help answer questions as well, since he has as much to do with this definition as I do. You can check out the definition as well online at either of these URLs. So.
Are these on?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So right now, 2006, a lot of the free software community, a lot of the open source community still thinks that non-commercial verbatim redistribution of creative works is sufficient. We see it in discussions in Debian. We see it, Richard Stallman goes around and gives his three categories of content discussion. Do you see any possibility of starting to work with the open source software community, the free software community, to kind of change those perceptions within one of the largest and most potentially friendly communities out there?
So I guess that there so the hard part is the you know, I wanted to kind of break this into two sort of arguments. The first is that like the free software movement, we need a definition of freedom, right? And I think that there's a lot of people who will agree with that from a tactical perspective. We need a definition. Now within that group, not everyone's going to agree on what that definition is or what is and isn't content or the important classifications of content. Some people say, oh, no. I mean, people have argued, I think, correctly that there are different types of works, and that perhaps, and that we should at least think about the possibility that they should be treated differently. And I've, you know, Richard Stallman says there are three kinds of works. They're primarily functional, primarily artistic, and primarily political or opinionated. I think that's roughly the distinction. There are other people who say, you know, music is one thing and should always be treated the same, and film is another thing and should be treated differently, and so on and so forth. I don't believe that absolutely everyone is going to subscribe to not our definition or anybody's definition, right? I think that there will be multiple competing sort of ideas. I mean, it's interesting to note that the shareware community had its own sort of definition of shareware as well, and they had a set of principles that they used. In that sense, there was the free software definition, and then there was the shareware definition. And then maybe there was out there somewhere the own everything, implicit proprietary definition, right? And those three things are competing. I mean, they've continued to compete to this day. I believe that the example of free software recently says pretty clearly that free software is going to win because it's more permissive. And I believe that, but ultimately, I mean, you know, mid-80s, most people thought Richard Stallman was crazy. Most software developers today, most software developers still think Richard Stallman is crazy. You know, the point here is not to get absolutely everyone to agree to something, but to create something that we think we can make a strong ethical argument in favor of. If you subscribe to this, work with this. If you think it's close enough that you can talk to us and maybe get a couple things changed so that you can subscribe to this, talk to us. That's why it's in a wiki and not, you know, something just kind of thrown out there. We would love to sort of make this argument in the free and open source software community. I think that because this is a community that understands full well, I mean, I could skip the first half of the talk where I describe how free software has, you know, been successful because of a set of definitions, because free software developers know, because that's why they do the work that they do. So, yeah.
I'd like to add that the problem with the non-commercial use only licenses is that people do not understand that this isn't about commercial use at all. It's about combining works. This is the most important factor. you put your work under a non-commercial use only license, it's not going to be possible to combine it with Wikipedia. It's not going to be possible to combine it with a vast array of other works out there which are under more permissive licenses. So if you compare copyright to continents, then free content is the ocean. And non-commercial use only licenses are little islands, clusters of islands that can only communicate with each other. And I think that's pointless. What's the point of it? It's overrated to try to use copyright law to prohibit commercial use when you're already giving away your work for free anyway. The idea being, oh yeah, but someone might come along and do something I don't like. Sure, someone might come along and do that, but think about what that might actually be. You're giving away your song for free download on your website. You're giving away your book. You're giving away your picture. So what uses are there actually going to be? And are you willing to enforce your copyright against those who abuse it? Are you actually willing to use copyright law? I think there is a legitimate case to make that in certain contexts where you, for instance, produce music and you want to go towards the traditional exploitation model of music, sure, you can use a non-commercial use-only license if that is what you want, if that is what you're trying to achieve. I don't have a problem with that. What I am saying is that people should be aware of the consequences. What I am saying is that Creative Commons is not doing enough to make people aware of the consequences. And what I am saying is that we are trying to create a broader movement that defines clear goals that people can subscribe to, that seeks to create alternative models to create content, and that seeks to build, as Maker said, a social movement. So with that said, please, further questions. Yes, in the back. Can you come to the microphone, please? Thanks.
What time is lunch? Do we get to hear the other
speaker? We have about 5 minutes left for questions, and then we'll continue with Walter.
I wholly agree with your thoughts on non-commercial, and of course, I actually personally urged Creative Commons to at least offer some expiry periods so that people could, if they really have to license not work as non-commercial, at least it expires after a short period of time. Maybe that would help. But I do have an objection to the idea that there's no such work that could be either political or artistic that you would, where non-derivative would be inappropriate.
I don't think that we're saying that there aren't works where that would be where it could be appropriate or that it shouldn't happen. I mean, the point is that free software didn't eliminate non-free software. In fact, most software is non-free software, but it allows people to choose where they sit on that line. You could make the explicit choice to release something as non-free software, and you could make the explicit choice to use it, but you can know which side of the line it's on.
But our definitions are it's not like we're going to allow derivatives of our constitution. It's clear that there are going to be documents that are
so,
fixed.
So you could make a derivative of a constitution.
Other countries have.
They've taken bits and pieces.
Most importantly, you can translate it, and that is one of the most important use of derivatives.
The point is what's the fear that someone's going to make a version of the Constitution that's a little bit different and it's no longer the Constitution, right?
I want to add something there because that's been a discussion that's gone on for quite a bit in the Wikisource community a few weeks ago where someone raised the argument, oh, well, Wikisource is our Wikimedia repository of source documents like constitutions, legal documents, whatever. And someone said, why don't we just accept Creative Commons no derivatives licenses in Wikisource since it's meant to be authentic? And I think that is silly because the point is that you're using law to prevent something which you could prevent with policy. If you want to prevent people from doing certain things, then prevent that using the rules of your community, say that this document is not modifiable. If you actually prevent derivative works in the legal sense, translations become impossible. What is the point of Wikisource? The point of Wikisource is not just to duplicate Project Gutenberg. The point of Wikisource is that you have a collaborative community that can work together to provide added value to archives that already exist. And one of these added values is translations. So I think, in fact, from my personal view, that is the greatest value that Wikisource can add. So from my point of view, using no derivatives there would be absolutely pointless.
But I want to point out a little bit of a problem which I think hasn't been adequately disclosed by the way you talked it through, Meka. One of the reasons that the software world succeeded in making share-alike licensing work was that nobody on Earth knew how to apply the moral rights theories of half the world's copyright laws to software. And so the question of the protection of work integrity was not a problem that we had to find an affirmative way to solve. It was a benefit of parochial US life at the beginning of the free software movement's legal existence, and a benefit of the weakness intellectually of the moral rights community's response to digitalization that we didn't have to. Once you begin to work within the context of forms of works of authorship which are traditional, like literary text and images and so on, you encounter immediately a layer of legal analysis guaranteeing the integrity of the work as part of the human rights of the author. And the deontological reasoning from moral principles that you want to do becomes more complicated, and you wind up in a controversy over ethics, which is far more subtle and difficult to deal with than the technological licensing work that we did earlier, or are doing now, for that. I think this is exactly the right line to be on. But I think that the principal moral argumentation which we need to make isn't the thin form of argumentation that you've so far advanced. That's barely good enough to attack the question of Creative Commons dependency on non-commercial use licensing. It's not broad enough or deep enough to deal with the real challenge for moral rights thinking, which is the intellectually hard work ahead.
You want to answer? You have something to say?
Actually, Eben, what we would like to do is sit down with you and Richard and discuss what we can actually do to advance a broader social movement. And I absolutely agree that this sort of thinking about works integrity is something which we haven't really addressed yet. There's other aspects which we've been arguing about, which we seek your input on, such as, is content really an appropriate term? Richard Stallman has argued strongly against the term content. When I started the definition, I actually used the term free content definition because that was what Wikipedia was using at the time, and I'm fine with that, and I want it to be adopted by Wikipedia, so I've argued strongly that the name content should be in there. Make a plausible argument that artists might be uncomfortable calling their work content because that is sort of a work that in the last 20 years has been used very extensively to say, oh yeah, we are creating content and we're doing it, you know, exploiting it and whatever. It's a commercial term from the dot-com era to a large extent, and we're trying to create some distance to that connotation.
Content is also a term that I think solves some of that problem because it refers to the set of works for which people don't seem to have that same sort of moral rights connection. When it's a couple of edits you made in an encyclopedia, it's not the sort of thing that you are likely to articulate some sort of moral rights position in relation to. So in that sense, part of the reason it's been more successful with works like with Wikipedia, and with the types of works that people self-identify as content, makes that a little bit easier. Moving forward, it opens a lot of tricky problems, both legal sort of problems and problems with implementation and the instruments that we'll use to get there, and with some tricky sort of ethical questions as well.
Okay, so we don't have room for any more questions.